My name is Red Aldridge, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. Welcome you guys in that 24 hours or more category. There's no way in the world that I'd ever try to stand up at this podium and tell anybody in this room whether they're alcoholic or not. I don't believe I'm qualified to do that. However, if you happen to start identifying some of these innermost feelings that I'm going to be trying to talk about, some of these symptoms of this terminal disease that I have, I'd sure as hell pay attention. Because what we're dealing with here is a terminal disease. Just roll that over your tongue a couple of times. That's got kind of a final ring to it. Means that if you continue to use and abuse the mind-altering drug alcohol, and don't let anybody ever tell you that alcohol is not a drug. Alcohol falls right in the drug category with the ethers and the anesthetics. It's one of the oldest known drugs to man. And it's probably been used and abused by man longer than any other drug. And it's probably killed more men and women than any other drug. I used and abused it over a period of time, regardless of how long it took, until I actually broke my tolerance to it. If you are actually new on this program, or fairly new, and you're wondering why alcohol was giving you so much trouble physically, it's because you've become allergic to the drug alcohol. See, when old Red drinks alcohol, I break out in spots. Spots like Acapulco, Las Vegas. In other words, once I pick up the first drink of that mind-altering drug, I can no longer predict my behavior. If you've been having trouble along those lines, I'll guarantee you that tonight you're in the right place. This physical allergy that I developed over a period of time to this mind-altering drug is not necessarily what makes it the killer that it is today. You see, there's a mental side of this disease, and it's the real serious one. It's called the obsession of the mind, and it's triggered, incidentally, by the first drink of that mind-altering substance that you put into you that tells you that this time it's going to be different. This time I'll be able to predict. This time I'll be able to control. This is the time that alcohol is going to work for me like it always used to. You see, if you be alcoholic like old Red and you pick up that first drink, you trigger your obsession to drink. In the alcoholic, it'll immediately set up a compulsion to drink, and you're going to end up maybe not today, maybe not even this week. But once you trigger that obsession, once you set up that compulsion, you're going to end up in another devastating bout with this mind-altering drug in which you're just one step closer to the insanity and death that Wally was reading about a minute ago when he read from that portion of chapter 5 from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So the whole idea, if you're new, the whole concept of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is to teach us on a daily basis how to stay away from that first drink. You know, the first 100 guys and a gal that were on this fellowship that were able to do this a day at a time for a year got together and they wrote down what they had done. They called it the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I got to believe that that first 100 guys and a gal must have been spiritually led. It's over a period of the last 25 years that Red's been sober a day at a time. I have never found myself in a situation that I couldn't find the solution to in that Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous before it was necessary for me to go out there and pick up that first drink. And almost all the answers come in those 12 suggested steps that you heard Wally read a minute ago. Those are the suggested steps to recovery used by that first 100 guys and a gal that were able to stay sober a day at a time for a year. If you were paying attention when Wally read them a minute ago, they are suggested steps to recovery. But I can guarantee you that there's not a guy or a gal sitting out there tonight with any length of sobriety at all that ever had them just suggested to them. You're going to have to take them. You're going to have to do the best you can with them on a daily basis for the rest of your life if you want to become a survivor. Take a look around you in a room like this tonight, and what you see are the survivors of a terminal disease. A disease from which there is no cure, a progressive disease that's going to continue to get worse for the rest of your life, whether you drink or not. If you wonder why Red's standing up here tonight still yapping about the same old thing after 25 years of sobriety, it's because it's a hell of a lot more important for me to stay sober today than when I was in that first 30 or 60 or 90 days. Because you see, my disease has continued to progress. Ellen and I had a very dear friend not too long ago with 22 years trial. That lady started to drink at 10 in the morning, and by 4 that afternoon she was dead. This is the progression of the disease called alcoholism. I said a minute ago, regardless of how long it took, I say this from podiums around this area anymore, because as I look at these audiences, they keep getting younger on me all the time. Maybe it's because I'm just getting so damned old. I don't know. But a lot of times I think youth thinks maybe they got here too soon. If you're thinking like that, my God, forget it. The average age of death today of the guy or the gal with a disease called alcoholism is down to 37. Take a look around you. You see a lot of us old jokers still staggering around. So you know how many kids have got to be dying to bring it down to anything like that. It's not extraordinary at all anymore for somebody to go through the gates of insanity and death before their 16th birthday. Coupled with some of that crap that's out there on the street tonight, pushing this progression along, it's not hard to pack 20 years of hard drinking into 4 or 5. So if you are in a room like this tonight, for God's sake, try to pay attention to some of these symptoms I'm going to be talking about, some of these innermost feelings, and maybe, just maybe, you might save yourself a lot of hell right here on earth. I'll get off of this bleeding deacon kick and qualify myself as an alcoholic. I like to get those licks in because a lot of times, you know, we get carried away with these war stories and we forget to get the real basis of this program to the newcomer. I didn't do any drinking at an early age. I had an obsession. I wanted to fly. I wanted to fly the biggest and the fastest airplanes that were ever built. I had a real drawback. I was born back in what they call the Depression years. I know a lot of you aren't old enough to remember them. I have a feeling you might have had a little touch of them in the last 6 or 8. But, you know, things were tough. I knew my chances of getting to do something like this were pretty slim. I started to investigate and seemed to know the only chance it'd have to be the military. Except back in those days, we didn't have an Air Force, per se. It was part of what was called the Old Army Air Corps. I found to even get into it, I was going to have 2 years of college and a senatorial appointment from the state. I was born in Colorado, a little town called Fort Collins, just north of Denver. I started out with this goal in mind. I knew the money wasn't going to be there for that college education due to the times, and I was no great student, but I was a big kid. I figured I could do it athletically. I stayed clean all the way through high school. I was out for football and basketball. I was lucky enough to win my football scholarship to Colorado State University. I wangled my 2 years of college that way. Got my senatorial appointment, and they sent me to what was then called Randolph Field, which was the old Army Air Corps Academy. And they kept me real busy through the rest of my training, and through that period of my life, booze was no problem. I just didn't use it. I graduated as a second lieutenant just prior to us getting into World War II. I see a few guys sitting out there tonight can probably remember how unprepared we were for that hassle. You know, our dads were supposed to fought one to end them all, and Congress had never seen too fit to appropriate the kind of a show we've got today. We got tossed into that North African campaign over there against a bunch of guys that had been sitting there practicing for a couple of years, and they got pretty damn good at what they were doing. We were strictly under-trained and for sure under airplanes. I found myself in a situation on that first tour in which a lot of times we were putting up 25 against 200. And we were getting the hell kicked out of us. I came back off of one of those raids very early in that first tour, and that particular day we only got 8 back out of the 25. Now I think a lot of you in rooms like this can identify with adrenaline. Mother Nature's drug. Usually triggered by fear. Fear of failure, fear of death, fear of the unknown. You get a near miss out here on the freeway, you handle it real good. You get a half mile down the road, you can't keep your foot on the accelerator. That's adrenaline. You know, and it was pumping through me. It had been pumping through me pretty good for about 6 hours out there. I was standing in a room very similar to this, tables on each side waiting to go in to talk to the interrogators about what had happened. And old Ed was shaking. I was shaking in every bone in my body. Now, I wasn't too worried about adrenaline shakes. I'd had them before. You stand there and wait for that football to come down with that 250-pound lineman about to nail you, and you'll quiver. I don't give a damn who you are. But you get in the game and you get over it, and I knew I'd get over it. But this flight surgeon wasn't that sure. He stood there and looked at me for a few minutes. He says, "What's the matter, Ed?" And I said, "Nothing. I'll be all right." He looked at me for a few minutes. He says, "Young man, I got just what you need." I had never paid too much attention to that medicinal table that they had set up there in operations. But on it, they had about a half a dozen open fifths of what they call medicinal whiskey. Think about that for a few minutes. Whiskey is a medicine. He reached over and he picked up a water glass and he poured me about two fingers and he said, "Here, drink this." And I said, "I really don't want it." He says, "Young man, I prescribe it." Just to get him off my back, I picked it up, turned it up, drank it down, walked on into interrogation and sat down. And if you've got an alcoholic personality like I have, I think you know what happens. Man, that stuff sit there and it floated out there to those fingertips and out there to those toes, and all of a sudden I'm sitting there real comfortable. I looked down and they were roped. 10 minutes before, I hadn't been able to light a cigarette or pick up a cup of coffee. 10 minutes down the line with a half a glass of booze in me, I'm looking at them and they're frozen just like they are tonight. Old Red never shook at anything again for the next 20 years. I thought I had found the elixir of life. I really believed it, and booze worked out well for me for a long, long time. I soon found to get the full benefit out of it. I had to keep recreating the kind of a situation I'd had that first day. Probably combat's the best adrenaline builder I ever found before or since. And I became a combat freak. I stayed 3 years and two tours of duty, and I got good at what I was doing. I learned to live on that knife's edge, that fast lane. I think a lot of you can identify with it. You know, booze was always there at the end of the day to handle anything I couldn't handle. I used to come in at night and see guys sitting on the edge of their beds worried about going the next day. I'd look at them and think, "God, I wish they could find alcohol." You know, it never dawned on me that maybe it worked a lot more for me than it did for them. I went right on through World War II. I was back here in the States. I probably should have been able to lay that medication down and go on about my business. But I think in retrospect, I started running into one of the first symptoms of this disease. Some of you might identify with it. It's called justification. Rather than laying it down, I went looking for a job that had some adrenaline in it. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that we got today, were just coming off the drawing boards. They were looking for guys that had a lot of combat experience to evaluate them. I put my application in, and I got accepted as a test pilot to the Proving Ground Command. Hell, the excitement was back. I was flying the kind of airplanes now that I'd laid on those Colorado hillsides and dreamt about when I was a kid. I was flying with the best, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. I think it started maybe working a little bit too well. Proving Ground Command is Eglin Field in Florida. In fact, it still is. They got a big officer's club built right out there in the Gulf there at Fort Walton. I used to catch myself an awful lot of nights hanging out at that club until 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, just kind of tranquilizing the day. I'd know I had a 6:30 test on. Now, not always for sure. But every once in a while, I'd wake up in that DOQ at around 11 o'clock in the morning with that cold sweat start we come to in. I'd look at my watch and say, "Did I or didn't I?" You know, you'd pick up the phone, call the sergeant and say, "Did everything written up they wanted this morning?" "Yes, sir, right down the line." You walk back down to the line, you step up on the wing of that bird, and the knee pad is yours. The checkoffs are yours. The signature's yours. Geometer says you've been up to speed of sound and the only thing you can't recall is going. Now, don't kid me that it hasn't happened to you. You step out there on that porch in the morning, that car sitting in the driveway, you say, "How did it get home last night?" Or, "How did I get home last night?" Another symptom of this disease is called blackout. The overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol to the point that it blacks out the conscious mind. If you've got any coordination at all, you're going to get by with all kinds of it. Hell, I've seen guys go for a week in a blackout. You'd never see them stagger. And yet they had no conception of where they were or what they were doing. Should just scare the living hell out of an alcoholic, and I don't believe I've ever found one that it bothered too much. We'll write it off the idea that, God, I must have had a good time last night. We're willing to take somebody else's word for it. In the occupation that I was in, I knew it wasn't what I was looking for. I started my first feeble attempts, I guess, about this time in my life at control. I'd always been a binge drinker at the end of the day. I figured if I was going to exercise any control at all, I had to string it out over a longer period of time. I think that's how an awful lot of us become daily drinkers. I gave up binge-type drinking, but I sure as hell didn't give up drinking. I just strung it out. And I think what I became over a long period of my life is what I like to refer to as a functioning drunk. All the real good airplanes, the jet-type airplanes that I'd really wanted to test were off the drawing boards anyway. I was looking for something maybe had a little more adrenaline to it. As usual, the Air Force come up with it. We found that we let way too many guys out right after World War II. They started a big recruiting campaign to get the key personnel to come back. One of the promotional aspects they come up with was the organization of what's still known today as the Air Force Demonstration Team. Probably most of you have seen that team at one air show or another around the country. You don't get sentenced to that team, you volunteer for it. They screen you pretty good. You do have to have all the qualifications. I was lucky enough to have them, and I got accepted. Now, they only let you do it for 2 years because it is an adrenaline-building son of a gun. It's not all fun and games. You practice at it 4.5 days a week, and you fly 32 air shows around the country a year. But I was back flying with the best again, and I knew it. Booze was still working for me. I think I started running into another symptom about this time that maybe some of you might identify with. It's called hangover. God, I have never found, and this is before or since, a worse place to shake a hangover than an aerobatic formation. You just think about it for a few minutes. You walk out there in the morning, that canopy comes down over you, and you're trapped. There's no way in the world you're going to stop at a corner tavern, that's for damn sure. You hook that oxygen mask across your face and you can no longer become ill. You pull into that 18-inch interval formation and those guys just insist that you don't shake. You do a lot, maybe you might identify with this one. It's called the deep sweats. God, I used to sit there and wonder how come. How come something that's worked for me so well for so long is kicking me around like this? I used to try to analyze it. You know, I got to thinking, hell, maybe it's the life you lead, Red. Maybe at the end of your 2 years, if you'd resign, get out, get in civilian life, get a business going, get a family started, do the things that I'd seen my buddies do, that I could get a handle on this drinking. I always believed right up until I had both feet to the gates of insanity and death that given the right set of circumstances, I could control my drinking. I think this philosophy of self-sufficiency that we all grow up with from kids, where every guy and every gal should be an island to themselves, is probably what helps about 14 to 16 million of those practicing alkies that are out there tonight self-medicate themselves right out of this world without ever finding what we find in rooms like this, that there is a way out. I finished my 2 years, I resigned, I hit civilian life. You know, all my buddies had been out there about 4.5 years ahead of me now. They'd completed their educations, they had positions, they had homes built, they had families started. If you're anything like I am as an alcoholic, you know what you're going to do, double up and catch up. And this is the way I hit civilian life. I went into business. It was immediately successful. In fact, it's the same kind of business I'm still in today. You guys contributed an awful lot to it in your drinking careers. It's called the auto body business. I built that tri-level home. I got the family started. Everything was going great. I think I'd have been all right if I'd have just worked at it 8 hours a day. But I was going to catch those jokers. I was working 12 and 14 and 16 hours a day. I went to 6 days a week, and then I put on 2 shifts. Until I got that tri-level home down there and paid for it a short period of time. I got a trust fund started for the kids to get them through college, and hell, they're only 1 and 3. You know, this is the way we think, and this is the way we drive, and I'd come through those doors at night so damn beat I could hardly hold my head up, flop in that easy chair, and there was one thing I could sell red on. Man, if there's anything you've earned yourself today, thank you. And you know what it was a drink of booze, and I was no better off than I was sweating hangovers at 30,000. A strange thing happened to me about this time in my life. Old Harry Truman got his foot in his mouth and sicked us on Korea. I was telling you, we hadn't trained any fighter pilots, and he knew it. He had to call the war worries. God, just 21 days from the day I was recalled, I looked out there, I got 2 500-pound napalms nailed to each wing again. They're saying, sick 'em, Tiger, they just went that way. I got another 100 missions to do. You know, I'm 33 years old by this time. Maybe they don't sound old, but it's getting old for a fighter pilot, especially one with a progressive disease. I had no idea that I had a progressive disease. Hell, I was still passing Class A physicals every 6 months. How could I have a disease? But when I started to do that new 100 in Korea, something became quite evident to Red in a hurry. Those damn missions had got too long between drinks. I think these chains of alcoholism, and I steal this from my wife's pitch, lie so lightly on our shoulders that a lot of us have no idea that they're there until we're completely enmeshed. So all of a sudden we wake up one morning to the fact that we are no longer telling alcohol when we're going to drink it. Booze is beginning to tell us when we're going to drink it. I solved that situation very simply. I went over to the PX and bought myself 2 8-ounce flasks, one for each winter flight boot, and it worked great. I'd use the right one going out and the left one coming home. A long time after Bruce started doing to me, it would still do for me, and I think a lot of you can identify with that. I think it was brought out very vividly to me just about how hooked I was really getting. Long about my 40th mission, I got shot up again for about the umpteenth time of my life, and the shell come through the bottom of the airplane and come right through my left leg, and it kicked it clean on my chin. You know, I can still remember getting my foot back down on that rudder, and I could feel liquid running into my left winter flight boot. I still remember sticking my hand down there and pulling her back and thinking, hot dog, it's blood. Only alcoholics identify with that. I've been shot up before. If you have been, you know how fast it puts you in shock. If you're hooked on a drug, it'll put you in withdrawal just about that fast, too. I still had an hour to get home, and I was damn glad to find my medication still intact. I finished my 100. I got back here to the States. I got to thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you could find yourself a flying job someplace far enough away from booze. Maybe there's someplace you can get in this world where it's not so readily available. I started looking for that new assignment. They were just starting to build the radar sites up across the Arctic Circle. I was talking to an Alaskan just before the meeting. Just come down from there. He'll know what I'm talking about. Hell, the only way you stay alive up there is to drink booze. Freeze to death in that part of the world. Now, I spent a year in Thule, Greenland, where the warmest day we had was 23 below. So cold winter just won't do it. I finally volunteered to come down to Harmon out of Thule. Thule's only about 450 miles from the North Pole. I volunteered that weekend to come down to Harmon, that big Seagram's distillery there in Newfoundland, to pick up the monthly ration of booze for that base up there. I brought down a twin-engine airplane and loaded her clear down with those big 40-ounce Canadian jugs of that CC and VO. I started back up there that night, and I got in one of the damnedest Arctic storms I was ever in, and I lost an engine. It was one of those nights I called Air Sea Rescue, and those bastards wouldn't even come out. I fought that thing all night. I got into Thule just at Arctic dawn, and the whole base was down there to meet me. I got to thinking, isn't it great they're that worried about old Red? So I rolled back that window, and the first thing they asked me is, you didn't salvage that load, did you? It never even crossed my mind. I don't know whether you guys had this problem or not. The speaker this morning was talking about it. When you drink booze all day, you begin to smell like booze all day. And that's what I was beginning to do. I was beginning to smell like booze all day. That keen alcoholic thinking. I got to thinking, you know, maybe if I'd get back to Europe where they got that wine on the table and they eat a lot of garlic, that at least I'd blend in better. I volunteered for Fleet Line Service, which is the airline that resupplies NATO. I went back over, and my northern run was Brussels, Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Oslo, and Stockholm. Now, those are progressive disease towns, I guess. I was picking up a lot of rank over the years. They kept trying to trap me for command, and they got it done about this time. They jerked me back here to the States and gave me an air defense group, stuck me up here at Hamilton, just outside of San Francisco. Now I got about 800 men in my command. You know, I'd hear my airplanes roll every morning. Seemed like invariably I'd look out there at that outer office of mine, and that adjutant would always have about a half a dozen of my boys sitting out there waiting for me to talk to. I found out an awful lot of my mornings used to be taken up counseling. These kids had been in town getting themselves into trouble drinking. I had a system. I had an eyes-on safe alongside of my desk. I used to keep a 40-ounce jug of Smirnoff Red Vodka in there with a hooked glass straw, and every time he'd go out to get one of those boys, I'd hit the safe. Usually by noon, I was giving some pretty damn good lectures on the evils of drink. Also knew that sooner or later, I was going to get in a lot of trouble. The Air Force had always been awful good to me. I figured I sure as hell owed them a lot more than I was giving them. And again, I decided to resign. And this time, it didn't work. My resignation got as far as Air Defense Command at Colorado Springs, and they bounced it. They bounced it with a recommendation that we sent to Parks, which is one of the big Air Force hospitals, for 3 months psychoanalysis. They thought I was suffering from delayed combat fatigue. Well, you can't very well go in there and tell those guys what you're suffering from. If we had any other terminal disease in this world, we'd have been in there on that doctor's doorstep, laying the symptoms on. You know, telling him, God, Doc, this is where it hurts. Yet you can drag that dying alcoholic into that same doctor's office, reading that same set of questions when it comes to that one where it says, do you drink excessively? Oh, a couple of beers now and then, Doc. Self-denial, the greatest symptom of all the symptoms I've talked about tonight, our complete lack of our innermost selves to get honest enough to admit that alcohol has just taken us to pieces. They did let me out. Now, psychiatry was the first help that was ever offered to me as an alcoholic. I don't believe that it can help the practicing alcoholic due to the self-honesty bit. Don't get me wrong. Now, I don't believe that there's a guy or a gal in here that psychiatry can't help. I got to tell you my psych story. It's about a guy about like I am. This guy had an obsession. He had an obsession. He had a purple screw for a belly button. Now, I knew it was an obsession, but every time he looked down, there's that bright purple screw right where his belly button should be. He hadn't had a good night's sleep in months worrying about this thing. He finally goes to this shrink, and he says, do you think you could help me? The guy says, I know I can. He says, I just got a new potion in. He says, I want you to take it home with you, get in your best pajamas, open your bedroom window, drink this stuff down. He says, you're going to drift right off to sleep. In will float a little pink cloud. It'll have a little yellow-handled screwdriver on it. Unscrew that thing, lay it up there, let her float out, and you'll be all right. He looked at him and says, Doc, I'm going to try it. He went running home. He went through the routine, and it worked. In floated the little cloud. He unscrewed it. Out it floated. Got the night's sleep he'd been looking for months. Woke up the next morning completely refreshed. Covers were up. Finally got his nerve up, took a quick look, and sure enough, normal belly button. He was just elated. He jumped out of bed and his ass fell off. Now, the reason I tell you this story is it's exactly the way that psychiatry worked for Ole Red. They would fix me up. They would say, "You're fine, Tiger. Go get him." I'd jump out there and off it'd fall again. They never mentioned one time through that session that it might be my overuse and abuse of the mind-altering drug alcohol. This was long before it was recognized as a disease. They did let me out. Family has long since got tired of my shenanigans and been on their way. My folks had moved out here to the West Coast. They'd been pretty successful, and they had a home over there on the top of Palo Verde Hills over there behind San Pedro. I figured I'd get up there in that big den with that boob tube and that beautiful view of Los Angeles Harbor. All the pressures are off that I've been drinking at for a long time. And I'll get a handle on this drink. I lasted about 2 weeks up there, and I was going out of my gourd. There was one of these big wooden globes, one of those Columbus pipe globes, sitting in that den. I kept looking at that thing and thinking, you know, maybe, Red, you've never taken a true geographic. I'd always been around guys that could cover for me, guys I'd thrown combat with or gone to school with. I figured if I'd get someplace in this world far enough away from anybody that knew me, that I'd have to do it on my own. I run my finger up over the meridian on that globe to see what was on the other side of the world from Palo Verde. If you want to try it, it's Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. One month later, I was flying captain on Ethiopian Airlines. I was halfway around the world again. Nobody knew me. All they knew was I had a hell of a lot of flying time and I was qualified. I gave it my best shot. I don't know whether any of you guys tried white knuckle sobriety or not, but I stayed sober a year on guts. And if you're thinking about it, my God, forget it. It was the most miserable year I ever spent in my life. There wasn't a waking moment in that year that I didn't want to drink. I used to wake up in the middle of the night and I'd have to go down to the kitchen, pour myself one, set it on the table and sweat it, not drink it. Prove yourself you got guts enough to leave it alone, Red. I'd go to a movie and I'd have to get up in the middle of it and go to the bar and have the bartender pour me one, not drink it, sit there and sweat it. That's the way I went through that year. At the end of it, I figured, well, there's one thing you proved, Tiger, at least you're not an alcoholic. And I went out to celebrate. It was my last fight. I don't remember fighting after that. We come up that hill so gradually, you finally get over on the back side of that alcoholic curve. And I can guarantee you that once you're on the back side of that curve, you're going to start to donate to the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Usually jobs, securities, homes, things that we've worked hard for most of our lives, all of a sudden you're going to find yourself tossing them into the pot to reserve your right to use this drug. Families, loved ones, people that have stuck by us through hell and high water, all of a sudden we're donating them to the pot to reserve our right to use this drug. If you want to hang out there as long as Red did, you're going to get into things like integrity, self-respect, anything that means anything to you on the backside of that curve, you've got to donate. I used to look down and I'd say, if I ever got like that joker, I'd quit. And pretty soon I'd be just like him and I'd say, I mean that one down there. And down that hill I went. It wasn't too many years before they quit renewing my airline contracts. In Africa about this time, most of those colonial powers were going independent. I found that there was a hell of a demand for the kind of flying I'd been doing most of my life. And all of a sudden I found Red shooting at people for money. You know, this has a funny effect on your insides. I'd always had principles to fight for through a couple of wars, and now I'm just sitting out there shooting at people to support a habit that I don't seem to be able to do too much about. There's an awful lot of other pressures that can be put on practicing alcoholics, as all of you know. I told you I'd been CO of an air defense group that had helped build a radar site. I'd had a top secret clearance most of my life, and all of a sudden I'm working for a foreign government. You hear things like OSI and CIA, you don't think too much about it, but those bastards are out there, and they can give a practicing alkie fits. They know who's paying you, they know how much, they know where you're banking it, they're opening your mail. Maintenance isn't worth a damn. You don't want to get shot down in that part of the world. All these pressures are building, and I'm doing the one thing that's always taking care of them. I'm pumping that damn flit, and man, it got rough. In fact, it finally got so bad that they just quit hiring me for that kind of stuff. I ended up, and I'm sure as hell not proud of this, flying through mountain passes with my landing lights on railroad tracks for navigation. Now my flights are low level over water. My landing fields are deserted beaches. My runways are flashlight lit. I have a feeling you know what I'm doing. I'm smuggling because that's where the money is. That's where all the fears are, too. If I get caught doing what I'm doing now, I know they'll put me away for life. And yet, alcohol took all those choices away. If you want to hang out there as long as Red did and you live, it's going to do the same thing to you. I kept right on with that kind of a crappy existence until I finally just got so bad they quit hiring me for it. I was back here in the States. I was 41 years old. I guess probably I was about as unemployable as a guy can get. I figured that there wasn't too many things I hadn't tried a couple times in this world, and if I couldn't whip it, at least I could get with it. I bought myself 10 cases of those 40-ounce jugs of that Smirnoff Red Vodka, and I stuck them in that hillside over there in Palo Verde. And I went on what was supposed to be old Red's last drunk, and it just damn near it was. That drunk lasted a little over 60 days. The last 30 of it, I was too sick to eat. People over on the side of that hill had no idea what was the matter with me. I'd been out there among them since I was about 18, and they'd never been around me that much. They knew I was getting awful sick physically. My normal weight's 220, and I was down to 138 pounds of emaciation, and most of that was liver. I think God stepped in about this time. Those people picked a doctor out of the phone book to see if he'd make a house call. Now, this was over 25 years ago. It was before detox or care centers or hospitals that would have anything to do with an alcoholic. But that doc that they picked out of that phone book actually made that house call. I know today that he didn't do it because of his Hippocratic Oath. They happen to pick one that's a member of a fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. He listened to those symptoms over the phone. He made that house call. He told those people what I was up against. Said he'd seen some amazing recovery on a program that he himself was on. That he was going to do what he could for me physically, and he was going to leave some names, and if I asked for help, to call you. I don't remember ever getting that well. He thought I was going to die, and they thought I was going to die, so I guess they just called you. My first recollection of you sober guys in rooms like this were those guys sitting on the edge of that bed. They literally nursed old Red back to health, and they started hauling me into rooms like this. And God, I was a tongue-chewing, wet-brained, babbling idiot, I'll guarantee you. It was a good 30 days before I even began to thaw out. But thank God you read this portion of chapter 5 like Wally did. I go to a lot of places around the world where they don't do that. But I think it saved old Red's life. I wasn't capable of hearing too much. I could hear, just don't drink today. And then they'd read those 12 suggested steps. And all of a sudden, over there in that old maritime group in Wilmington, I was sitting there one night, and it all come crashing in what I had been trying to put together. You see, for many years, drunk or sober, the only thing that ever kept me alive in those complicated airplanes I'd been flying was called a checklist. A list in which everything I had to do to get through one flight was written down. I'd never gone near a bird in my life, drunk or sober, that I hadn't used that checklist from the time I walked up until the time I walked away. And it would get me through just one flight. Sitting back there that night, all of a sudden it come crashing in, what 24 hours really is. 24 hours, just one flight in life. And those 12 suggested steps of the checklist are how to get through it without picking up a drink of booze. I've been using that 12-step checklist on a daily basis now for the last 25 years. I've never found it necessary to go back out there and pick up another drink of alcohol, tranquilizing, sedating, elevating pill. Haven't had to smoke any funny grass. I've probably been as close to chemically free as a guy can stay in this modern world. And I owe it all to you guys. See, on my own, I've given it my best shot, and I've never scratched the surface. Everything that I've been talking about tonight, I've learned in rooms like this. If you've got your hands up tonight, and you're in that first 30 days, and you said, my name is Red, and I'm an alcoholic, you pretty well got that number one step nailed. That's what we're talking about. We admit that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives are unmanageable. But if you're anything like I am, when you hit that step number two, that thing will just jar the living hell out of you. There's a real inference in that step. I'm going to have to ask a power greater than a Red to restore me to sanity. You know, before I can take that step, I got to admit I'm nuts. I got to admit that I was. Where else would you find a guy completely allergic to a drug that if he continued to use it was going to kill him, that went out there and pumped it down a couple of fifths a day? You know, there's got to be all kind of insanity in us before we come through those doors. Don't let it worry you too much. I'm going to tell you my insanity story. It's about a guy about like I am. I do a lot of yapping from these podiums down there in the basin, and by the time I get my shop closed in Long Beach and get out to Buena Park and change clothes and then double back up to the valley through that traffic and stuff, I'm always driving like a son of a gun to get there in time. This guy was doing the same thing. He only had about 10 minutes to make this meeting he had to speak at. He was on the freeway. His off-ramp was coming up. He thought he had it nailed. Hit the off-ramp, got a couple of blocks down the side street, and blew a tire. Went rolling off to the side of the road. He thought, well, maybe I can still make it. He ran around, jerked his trunk open, got his spare out, jacked his car up, whipped his lug nuts off, put him in a hubcap behind him. He's just setting his spare up. Car come whizzing along right behind him, caught the edge of the hubcap and flipped all his lug nuts right out in the weeds. And he's frantic. You know, he's out there beating his weeds to death and wringing his hands, and it's dark and he can't find them and he knows he's going to be late. And all of a sudden he heard a voice. He hadn't paid any attention where he drove to a stop. He looked up and he was parked right in front of an institution for the alcoholically insane. One of the inmates had been sitting up there on the fence watching all this. He says, hey, mister. And the guy says, I haven't got time to talk to you right now. He says, I'm in a hell of a hurry. The guy sitting up on the fence says, you know, I've been sitting here watching you. He says, I figured you must be. He says, hell, if I was in that big a hurry, he said, I'd take the other three hubcaps off, take a lug nut off each wheel, put that thing on there and get going. The guy looked at him and he says, oh my God, that's the answer, isn't it? He says, how did you come up with that? I thought you were insane. The guy says, well, I am, but that's no sign I'm stupid. The point I'm trying to make is this. All of us, when we come through those doors back there, are a wee bit bent out of shape. We've been out there kicking ourselves around for a hell of a long time. The mere fact that we come looking for help sure as hell proves that we're not stupid. This is where the answers are, in rooms like this. Guys and gals sharing their experience, strength, and hope with each other that we can solve this common problem. I hit that step number three, and I think most of you know what happened. I run into that word God. I went running for my sponsor, and I said, Mac, is that the God they're talking about? I thought maybe there might be a way out. He says, yeah, Red. I said, I haven't got a chance. I got 250,000 years in purgatory to do before I could even start this program. He says, you didn't read the small print, Tiger. I said, what's that? He says, a God of your understanding. I had no idea what he was talking about. I was going to have to turn my will and my life over to a power greater than red. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was one right there in front of me. You guys. I could look in your eyes and I could see that you were staying sober. The one thing that I'd given it my best shot and had never been able to do. I started using the group as my higher power. I could believe in group power. I'd been tucked up in groups all my life. As long as I was in the group, I had all the firepower in the world. It was only when I was out there as a straggler I was going to get my ass shot down. I started hanging with the winners, the guys that had some time on this program. I started listening to them, started picking their brains. And they taught me. They taught me real good about this power that today Red calls God. My sobriety on a daily basis is a gift from you guys and God. What I do with that sobriety is my gift back to Him. You see, He's let me become part of that pipeline of information started by that first 100 guys and the gal. The only way I can keep it is to keep giving it away. I got to be standing at that door back there when the new guy comes through. I got to have my hand out, share my experience, strength, and hope with him like they did with me when I came through that door. This is the fellowship called Alcoholics Anonymous. I got down to the end of that checklist, and I hit that number 12. You know, it said, having had a spiritual awakening, and nothing had happened. I got to thinking, you know, Red, you don't even have the slightest idea of what spiritual is. How could it happen? I got to go to a convention about my first 60 days. I heard a boy from the podium. He's gone now. But man, he sounded spiritual. I thought I'd take him aside after this meeting and I'll ask him how he found that. I did. I cornered him. I said, come on, tell me about spiritual. He said, I'm glad you asked, Red. He said, I had a hell of a time with that one. He said, I went over to the public library. He said, I got the dictionary now and I opened it up to that word. It didn't do too much for me. He says, I got all the dictionaries in the building down. He said, I opened them all up to the same word, copied all the definitions, took a consensus. He says, you know what spiritual is? And I said, that's what I'm looking for, something this alky brain can handle. He said, Red, spiritual is that which is not material. I started reading that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous to see what that first 100 guys and the gal had in mind when they put that in there. And you know, the more I read it, the more I came convinced that what they were talking about were my attitudes and my emotions. You see, these are the things that had always driven me back out there to pick up that first drink. Alcohol was merely a symptom of what was wrong with me. My attitudes, prior to finding you guys, and they'd been this way for a long, long time, when I'd step out there and take a look at the day, it was, oh God, another day. What you guys have taught me is to step out there and take a look at her and say, thank God, another day. You know, I've been granted one that I shouldn't have had. The average age of death when I came on this program was 41, and I told you a minute ago how old Red was. I just barely snuck in. It means that every day that I've been granted over the last 25 years, a day at a time is a gift from you guys and God, and you can't get too ungrateful for a situation like that. I get up here to a podium. I get up right on cloud 9. I got to tell you my attitude story. This guy walked into a barber shop not too long ago. He was right up on cloud 9. The barber got him in the chair and he says, what are you so happy about? He says, I got a 747 reservation going to Rome. He says, I'm going over there and eat some of that good Italian food. He says, I even got an audience with the Pope. The barber looked at him and says, what's the matter with you, man? He says, that 747 is the roughest airplane in the sky. He says, you'd be airsick all the way over there. He says, you start eating that Italian food and Montezuma's revenge is going to seem mild. He says, you know the Pope isn't going to have time for a commoner like you. Well, the guy had gone in there right on cloud 9. He came out after the haircut right down in the pits, you know, right where those norms he's dropped me usually. And he didn't see him for 30 days. And all of a sudden, the guy come bouncing back in, and he's really out of sight this time. He got him back in the chair, and he says, what now? He says, I made that trip. He says, that 747 is the smoothest airplane in the sky. He said, there wasn't a ripple going over. He said, I gained 10 pounds eating that Italian food, about the same that old Ed probably put on up here this weekend. He said, I even got my audience with the Pope. He said, I got to kneel at his feet and kiss his ring, and he says, would you believe he even had a question for me? So Barbara looked at him and he says, what could he have possibly asked you? He says, where did you get that lousy haircut? Just hang in there. Don't let them take it away from you. It's going to get better. I can't guarantee you get your wives back, your families back, your jobs back, your health back. But I can guarantee you that those 12 suggested steps are going to start giving you the tools to dig into that pile of stuff that you brought through that door. And I'll guarantee you that the more you start to dig, I think the more you're going to begin to uncover something that you can live pretty comfortably with on a daily basis for the rest of your time on this program. I still have an awful lot of trouble getting it right the first time. I don't know how you guys have that trouble or not. I think there's a little bit of conflict there yet between Red's will and God's will. I heard a story over in Vegas kind of illustrates what I'm talking about the other night. This guy, he must have been an alky. He'd been out of work all during that slow period we had. He'd finally got himself a great job in a supermarket in the produce department. He was keeping all the lettuce and tomatoes and vegetables and fruits and everything laid out, let down, and looking good. All of a sudden, one afternoon, this guy come walking in and he cornered him. He says, young man, he says, I want to buy half a head of your lettuce. Now, the kid looked at him. He says, I'm sorry, sir. He says, we don't sell half a head of lettuce. I deal with the public on a daily basis, and I know how irritating they can get when they want to be. And this guy stayed right in the middle of him. He says, look at it. He says, I'm a bachelor. Look at the price of that stuff. It'd just go to waste. He says, sell me a half a head of lettuce. The kid stuck with his guns. He says, no, sir, we don't sell it that way. He wouldn't let up. He says, why don't you go back and ask your store manager whether he'll sell me a half a head? By this time, the kid is steaming, and I can understand those kind of emotions. He goes charging back into that store manager's office. He says, there's some half-assed character out here that wants to buy half a head of lettuce. He turned around, and the guy had walked in right behind him. And he says, and this gentleman here would like to buy the other half. I still get it right the second time, just like he did. So much for attitudes. How about emotions? You know, in five different places in that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you really want to get with it and read it, it says the one trend that seems to run through all our personalities is a little thing called emotional immaturity. God, how could a 41-year-old fighter pilot be emotionally immature? You know, I had a hard time buying that in the beginning. I don't today. It's one of the character defects that I've had to work on the hardest over the last 25 years. I looked up that word immaturity in the dictionary. You know what it said? Childlike. My emotions had never grown up. It's brought out very vividly to me every Saturday morning, and has been for a lot of years out here in Buena Park where I live. Along about 9 o'clock every Saturday morning, there's a knock on a Red's front door. It's all the kids in the neighborhood gathered out there on my lawn wanting to know if I can come out and play. And I do. Every once in a while, my wife comes to the door and they say, oh, it's Red's mother. See what you can get away with when somebody's got 3 years and 10 months more sobriety than you have? I could never figure out how I always got along with kids so well. I always have, all my life. I realize today that the reason that I always did is because their emotions are my emotions. You see, I had never had to talk down to them. I talked directly to them, just like I'm talking to you emotionally immature jokers, and you know what I'm talking about. Did you ever see one of those little guys get mad? He gets red-faced, fist clenched, drawn back, swinging angry mad. Who does this remind you of? Hell, when I was 4 years old, they said, I got a red-headed temper. I said, I have, I'll cultivate it. You know, I worked on it. I really did. You watch one of those little guys when he's jealous, he's comping his best buddy. He's going to get his own way or else. Anybody identify with that kind of a feeling? He'll pick up a resentment and he won't talk to the rest of us for the rest of the day. He's going to punish us. Anybody identify? See, it's no wonder that we start growing up in rooms like this together. Hell, some of those kids that come knocking on that door have been doing it for over 20 years. Some of the kids that used to put their wheels back on their skateboards, now I'm helping Portland leave their automobiles. And we still got a good thing going. And when they got in trouble with that crap that's out there on the street tonight, they knew where to bring their buddies and themselves. And I've had a lot of luck in that direction. And I'd have missed it all. I'd have missed it all if it hadn't been for you guys. You know, emotional involvements. My sponsor said absolutely no for that first year. Now, I told you how much sobriety I have, and Nell and I are just about to celebrate our 24th year of sobriety together. So you can tell how I was listening. I was sitting there just like the rest of you guys, waiting for the most pretty girl in Alcoholics Anonymous to come through the door. And she did. Thank God I was still hanging on to my old ideas because she was married to somebody else. And thank God she got involved emotionally early in her sobriety and it hadn't worked out. But we did get together and we moved two chiefs under one roof with no Indians. I guarantee you that if you're going to try that, you better get used to a little bit of button pushing going on. We've grown up together. I think probably it's been the greatest experience that any married couple can ever have. I think one of the greatest things that this program has given us through growing up together is that we've become friends. You know, it's very, very seldom you become good friends with the guy or the gal that you're married to. We've got a good relationship going, and it's developed and has been given to us by this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I still have an awful lot of trouble, and I don't know whether you guys have this or not, with that turn it over button. I don't have too much trouble turning my will and my life over to the care of God. I have a little trouble leaving it there for any length of time at all. You know, when it starts getting good, guess who wants to take the credit for it? I had a perfect example of this a few years back that I like to close with. I had a bunch of situations down at the shop that morning. I got up. I'm still pretty good at procrastination. I hem and hawed around that house until I hit that 91 freeway going to Long Beach running late. Now, when old Ed hits a freeway running late, even to this day, strange things begin to happen. People get cut out. Horns get blown. Fingers get given. I'm building a head of steam. I haven't even got to work yet. Whenever I start to act that way, that old monster inside of me, that one that used to whip me right over there to that corner tavern, begins to lash. I got to run that checklist, and I hit that turn it over button, and it scrolls in the down position. I haven't turned anything over. I talked to God just like I'm talking to you guys. I said, okay, sir, I'll just go down and do the footwork. You handle it. I got down there that morning. None of that stuff that I'd anticipated ever did come in. Everything that did come in was just as smooth as glass. You know, it was a nice day. It was a nice day all the way through. I jumped in that same car that night, headed out 91 on the way home, just so I'm patting on the back for the way I handled that situation. And all of a sudden it dawned on me what I was doing, and I busted out laughing. And I looked over and the guys driving on each side of me on the freeway are tuning their radios trying to find out what the hell I'm listening to. But it reminded me of a story that I used to use back in my combat days about credit, where credit is due. I had 6 clusters to my DFC, and when I'd wear them, guys would look at me and say, "Where in the hell did you ever get those, Red?" I used to have a stock answer, though I got pushed in the pond. But the story goes like this. It's about a Texas rancher. He had one of the biggest spreads in Texas. Thousands of acres, big old Olympic-sized pool, big old barbecue area, rambling ranch house. Just as a conversation piece, he built himself about 150 yard across the alligator pond. He filled it with the meanest damn alligators he could find the world over. These big old 15-foot snappers. You know what? He didn't feed them too good. He kept mean out there. All these guys got out there one afternoon telling their war stories and drinking his split, and this Texan finally got a little tired of him. He says, "I'll tell you what I'll do." He says, "Any of you guys really want to prove your courage?" He says, "Anybody go down there and swim across that alligator pond, I'll give you my daughter's hand in marriage, $1 million or a ranch like mine." He figured no takers. He figured he'd shut them up for good. He no more turned his back and he hears all this commotion. He turned around and here this guy is out there swimming across that pond. And he is moving out. He's leaving a rooster pit. He made it. The Texan ran around and he helped him out. He says, "I've never seen such a display of courage." He says, "I'll stick with my bargain." He says, "I imagine you want my daughter's hand." The guy shook his head. He says, "Oh, no, sir." He says, "I'm already married." The Texan looked at him and says, "Well, then it's got to be $1 million. The guy shook his head and he says, "No, sir." He says, "I have an income for life." He looked at him and says, "Well, then it's got to be the ranch like mine." The guy shook his head and he says, "No, sir." He says, "My daddy left me one in his will." He looked at him and says, "Well, what do you want?" He says, "I want the name of that son of a bitch that pushed me in the pond." I want to thank Pete and the committee for letting me participate, and I want you all to remember, just remember, we all got pushed in that pond of alcohol. Probably no human power could have ever got us out of there. God can and He will if He is sought. May you find Him now. And may that power watch over us all, a day at a time, through the eternity of our spiritual existence. And I sure want to thank you guys for letting me share.